This is CliffCentral.com.
Richard, are we on track with the financial pack for my presentation to the board next week?
Well, hopefully. The team's very short-staffed, and it's taking such a long time to find a suitable financial manager for the division. We're way behind on all our forecasts and reporting.
Why don't you speak to the finance team? They're a consultancy that can help you with an experienced interim financial manager. You can have somebody to help you almost immediately. They'll hit the ground running with no long-term contracts and no upfront placement fees.
Go to thefinanceteam.co.za.
Welcome to the business section of our business masterclass. I'm Richard Angus, CEO of the finance team, your part-time financial executive solution. Joining me in studio as part of our panel is Leandi Streeter, a business coach and guide from Raise Corp. Welcome, Leandi.
Thank you, Richard. Leandi.
And Cynthia Schumann of the Ethics Monitor, staying on from the previous show.
Thank you.
Nice to have you with us. Our guest on the line is Dr. Yannette Minnaar of Pro Ethics. Yannette, thank you for taking the time to talk with us today.
Thank you.
Great. So one of the conversations that we've been having is this whole question of ethics, and we've actually decided we're not allowed to use the word ethics training. It needs to be ethics conversations, because that's a real, you know, training is almost implying you have to give somebody knowledge of something that they don't know. And the view in the room in the first part of the show was actually everybody knows what needs to be done. It's a case of, do they know how to get it done and what to do in certain circumstances. Now, Yannette, you've got experience in the legal space, I understand, in terms of specifically the whole context of some international legislation around things like bribery and boards and educating boards and executives around some of their responsibilities and duties and obligations around pieces of legislation in the, let's call it, wider ethical space. Can you just share with us a little bit of context in terms of some of the work that you do and some of the things that you find in that space?
Of course, Richard. It's interesting, through the years, we've seen ethics principles, which could easily be regarded as a soft issue, if I may use that term, being written into legislation. And one of the most prominent places we see that is in the anti-corruption legislative environment all over the world. Mm-hmm. Most of these anti-corruption laws are also extraterritorial in its jurisdiction, mm-hmm. which simply means that irrespective of where the crime, the bribe is paid or received, one may be prosecuted by whichever jurisdiction can establish authority over you.
Mm.
So one of the most far-reaching pieces of legislation we saw in the past few years is the new UK Bribery Act. I call it new, although it's dating from 2010, because we saw the implementation and now also the fines, the verdicts in terms of this act coming into play the past few years. So the UK Bribery Act is very broad in its scope and now introduces potential criminal liability for acts of bribery committed by employees or agents, even where a company was unaware that someone is acting as an agent is paying a bribe for them. And they specifically then say the company has a duty, a general duty, to prevent corruption and bribery from taking place. In other words, if one turns it around, it's that the company needs to ensure that its affairs is managed and performed in an ethical way, honestly, with integrity.
Now, I listen to what you're saying, and my alarm bells are just ringing with some of the people who found themselves on the front pages of many of the dailies of South Africa recently. I mean, you know, I have to ask myself the question, and I'm going to ask it straight. I mean, does somebody like KPMG find themselves potentially exposed here with that sort of legislation or not?
One could, if I haven't studied the detail of the case, and of course being a lawyer, it's always important to look at the full context, but broadly speaking, any company or a director of a company or a senior manager, in South Africa, the Companies Act now created the category of prescribed officers, mm-hmm. basically referring to any senior person in the company who's in charge of what it calls a significant portion of the business. Now, that's a very subjective term, and we still need to see how widely the courts interpret that. So a senior manager in charge of a part of the business authorizes or looks the other way when a driver is paid. And that, in terms of our companies, I think South Africa already makes you potentially liable, and not only liable in terms of company having to pay a fine or being fined, also now in one's personal capacity. So a wave goodbye to the family farm.
Yeah, well, I always go the, you know, orange is the new black. you know, the orange jumpsuit activities, as I call them, you know, the stuff that gets people put in jail. Those are the things that need to get people's attention. And I guess, you know, I mean, and everybody's picking on them, so let's pick on somebody else. You know, you look at the SAPs and the McKinseys of the world. I look at, and one of my questions is, you know, we look at the CFO of Eskom. I mean, there very clearly we have issues going down, very, very clearly, and there's, you know, all sorts of statements being made this way and that. I mean, reality, the Companies Act applies to state-owned enterprises as it does to anybody else. So, you know, anybody in any of these types of state-owned entities, et cetera, is still subject to the same requirements, et cetera. Now, I guess the question I'd have is, you know, You were talking now about legislation in the United Kingdom. I know there's Prevention of Foreign Corrupt Practices Acts in the United States. Obviously from the Companies Act stuff locally. Are we seeing an increase in prosecutions coming from these various pieces of legislation, or is this a little bit of a wait and see? Still, are we still in the honeymoon?
No, I don't think so. We've already, back in November 2015, we saw a judgment at the High Court in London that had issued the first deferred prosecution agreement for the DPA, and that was approved by the court. It was thereby agreed that the UK's Serious Fraud Office, and they've got real teeth, and ICBC Standard Bank was found guilty of certain transgressions, and that was basically that was found guilty of a transgression of Section 7 of the UK Bribery Act, in terms of which they failed to, two executives failed as a third party financial institution, failure to prevent bribery. And in this case, what was quite interesting is that there was no real focus on the fact that they actually knew and knowingly participated in the offence of bribery, but the fact that there were inadequate systems in place to prevent the bribery in itself already made them then guilty. So that's interesting. The court specifically referred to the fact that the applicable policy to prevent bribes from being paid was unclear, and it wasn't reinforced or implemented effectively. And they also specifically also said training did not provide sufficient guidance about relevant obligations and the procedure. The fines that we saw were significant.
What numbers were we looking at?
The total penalty was $32.2 million.
Sure, that's a little bit of a significant one. That's a fairly hefty fine to get somebody's attention.
Just to add injury, you know, insult to injury, the company also had to pay the cost from the Serious Fraud Office for the investigation, which is £1,000 in this case.
I love that. You have to pay for the guys that give you a hiding. It's like having to pay the traffic department the cost of the speed trap, hey?
Yeah. I think that's only fair. And, I mean, it brings one back to the Eskom scenarios. I mean, there's been more than one of those recently where my question always is to the public and, you know, civil activism. You say, at what point are we going to start holding private and public sector entities accountable for wasting our money, and in a private company's case, for deriving our economic growth taking away share owner value, etc.
Yeah. Well, I mean, I think we quite clearly have seen what the response is in the Bell Pottinger case in terms of where that company has ended. I mean, it is no more. Purely on the I'm reminded of the comments that, you know, somebody made. They said, you know, in the rest of the world, people would sit back and go, you know, this is just totally unacceptable. When you get to South Africa, when we get irritated with an international play, we really go to town on it. And I mean, it's quite clear in the Bell Pottinger case, there was a massive social uprising against that. What is really interesting for me is I look at it and I go, well, massive reaction to Bell Pottinger, yet we don't seem to be having the same local reaction to what's going on locally with our own politicians and people in local companies. It's just, it is quite scary. What also amazes me, and I mean, I have, unfortunately, because of my background and industry, I'm very obviously very close to what's going on in the KPMG space and watching that with very close eyes because of its impact on my profession. And I have to ask myself the question, you know, why are we not seeing more action from the South African Institute of Chartered Accountants against, for example, the then CEO of KPMG, who was involved in the whole scenario with the Guptas and the Oakby and the wedding, you know, the wedding planning part of the wedding planning audit, as we call it. You know, where's the action on the ground locally in South Africa against the CFO, the suspended CFO of Eskom? Why are we not seeing very public engagement happening? You know, I must say I've been bitterly disappointed, and you know, we've seen people like Iraj Abedian act quite decisively.
Wonderful.
Against, you know, in his role as a board member at Munich Re, he felt that they should be reconsidering that relationship very strongly, and he felt they didn't give it the due credence, and he stepped down from that board. You know, you've seen other entities. I saw the other day that the parliamentary medical aid fund has now rejected KPMG.
But Richard, that's a delicious irony, given the absence of political will to pursue the many, many misdemeanors at all the state-owned entities. So I didn't miss the irony of that one.
I will say one thing. If there's one thing you can learn from ethics in this country, is that irony is in play.
Indeed.
But I mean, I look at all of this and I go, my goodness, people. You know, what is it? You know, if you've got the UK, the US, and many other countries really, you know, pushing the elements of things like bribery and corruption and ethics engagements, you know, are we doing enough? Because, I mean, you know, and I must say, just remember, we're not the only country in the world with our little litany. I mean, you just look at some of the other countries around the world.
Yes, I mean, Brazil.
I think our friends in Brazil kind of, you know, seem to top it off there with us in terms of issues and commentaries and the likes. But my goodness, we seem to have more than our fair share. I mean, somebody the other day joked with me. They said, Abu Mungani, the gift that keeps on giving. Every week there's another round of email or expose. You know, are we doing enough at the, let me call it, conversational ethics level? So we're talking about, you know, ethics conversations as opposed to ethics training. Are we doing enough at that senior board level? I mean, you're dealing with senior executives in terms of, you know, the international legislation, etc. Are they sitting there worrying about this or not?
So I think what's quite interesting for me in many of the cases, if not the majority, I have a first conversation with boards of directors and executives. Many of them are completely uninformed of the potential repercussions. of transgressions in terms of not just playing a bribe, but ethics failure. For example, what the company didn't have adequate policies in place, and those who did often fail in not making it, you know, known through communication. It's not implemented, it's not enforced, there's no action, it's never spoken about in the company. Employees don't receive any feedback, we institute disciplinary action and criminal sanction against, for example, someone who stole from us, who paid a bribe, who was unethical, etc. So these all of those failures, firstly, often they are quite unaware of that. Secondly, just in terms of the legislative potential negative impact that it could have in terms of the prosecution, many of our South African big companies have some sort of business interests in the UK, be it a registered officer, being a transaction that one has with a joint venture partner, or any contract that's paid, for example, in dollars, well, in this case, in pounds. And that immediately makes the UK authorities, it gives them jurisdiction. And that's what I'm seeing, is many of my clients are not being prosecuted locally, but they're being prosecuted abroad. Mm-hmm. And then one hears these types of penalties that I've just mentioned earlier in the Standard Bank case. And that is scary also to my clients. But apart from that, if I go one step back just quickly, one must bear in mind that we have almost three levels of, I use a very simple little diagram. The first thing, what does the law allow? Is it legal? May I do this? I can make money by selling drugs, but it's illegal. So that's an ethical question, right? The second one is, what do our company policies and procedures allow? Is it do business at any cost, even if it means paying a bribe, to as long as we make money? Or do we have adequate procedures in place to prevent wrongdoing from happening in the first place? And then thirdly, do we have as a company a strong ethics statement, a strong set of core values that bind us as employees together and that create that aspired standard of behavior for all of us working in this organization, so that we know even if the policy doesn't address this type of behavior, it's still wrong to be a racist. It's still wrong to do something that's unethical and that, for example, harm my company's good name.
Yes.
So those three, what the law allows, what our policies and rules allow, and what our company values allow. And many times I've seen that the board doesn't quite realize all. They might be very compliant, excellent compliance officers, excellent company secretaries, strong legal, they might have good HR departments that enforce the policies, but then they might lack a strong ethics office. So the moment one has, and that's the strongest part to have, because that speaks the ethical culture is the most important part.
Yeah.
Because failure of an ethical culture immediately allows me to say, well, it's not forbidden by law, neither by rule, so I take it that it's allowed.
I'm interested, Janette, in what your experience is around bribery, where there's so often the justification of saying, yes, but in X country, that's normal practice and it's the only way we can do business there. How do you find your clients are dealing with that? Are they rationalizing it, or are they in fact applying the higher standards of their country of origin?
I genuinely think that they are uninformed. I've been privileged to train all over Africa on anti-corruption legislation, from Tanzania, right through Ghana, Nigeria, etc. And I am yet to come across an African country where the paying of a bribe is allowed.
Yeah.
And also extraterritorial jurisdiction. So even if the company gets away with paying a bribe somewhere on the African continent, the moment it has a transaction with some joint venture or for example, an American, partner or British, registered officer, et cetera, one is in trouble.
Yes.
Because they may prosecute one for paying a bribe, for example, in Mozambique.
Yes.
Mm-hmm. And that is a real danger. And the moment one, and I've dealt with those cases, the cost of defense of those types of criminal actions brought against one often comes very close to the fine itself.
Mm.
And it's incalculable. It's huge. And again, it brings us back to, as an employee, that should make me very unhappy, because our company is not going to make profit next year because we have to pay. And of the companies who've just been fined for, fixing prices or colluding in the market.
Yes.
Mm. Now, I listen to this and I think to myself, it's very clear that the international community is putting a stand in, and I think we've seen that both locally as well. I mean, I'm very aware of local companies that act very decisively around fraud and bribery and corruption. That, but why then is this still such a topical conversation? Because it's almost like everybody's talking about the right thing to do. We all believe in the right thing to do. It's out there. The awareness is up. Yet people are still doing the wrong thing. I mean, it almost feels again. You know, it's that saying, like, against the tide we choose to swim. You know, and you kind of go, okay, it's clear. It's transparently obvious that this is not acceptable, yet you guys are still proceeding down this road. Why do you think people, or why is it that we're dealing with people that just, let me call it, kick against the system like this and still choose or try and run business this way?
I think it's uninformed opinions. They think it's profitable. And it's short-term, making short-term profit.
Mm-hmm.
In other words, if I pay a quick bribe now, or I act a little bit unethical, for example, by labor abuses, as long as we make money this year. So we know from ethics, companies with very strong ethical cultures and all the empirical studies that are done, and they are freely available, that being ethical actually pays.
Mm. Mm.
Companies with an ethical culture make more money, bottom line.
Yes.
And those sort of directors and managers who still defend unethical behavior and criminal behavior by paying bribes are blatantly only looking after their own pocket, in my view. And I think it's time that we as people of the country, be it as an employee, be it as a citizen, be it as, a watchdog body, like, for example, the Institute for Chartered Accountants, take a stand to say to those individuals, no, we won't tolerate that.
Mm.
Yeah. But I also think all too often, if we look at some of the high-profile figures that have been named here in South Africa, I think the rewards are so vast that they're trapped in a system that they just don't want to let go. And I'm hoping it's the dying days, but are hanging on to sort of eke the last bit of illicit reward out of the system.
Yeah. I mean, I must say that I look at all of this and listen to this, and I think to myself, wow, we almost have lip service, being paid in many cases by, and I mean, let's be frank here, look at the, and I'm going to name them, look at the SAPs, the McKinseys. I mean, these are not state-owned enterprises of South Africa. These are big corporate companies.
Yes.
And they have so clearly in our case overstepped the mark on a multitude of issues here. And I kind of look at this and I go, okay, they proffer a view or a perspective of, hey, we are the ethical consultants, McKinsey. Right. So, and we are the ethical IT provider, SAP. Yet, when I look at this, I go, how does their internal system allow this to play out? Because definitely, it's happened clearly at levels in the organization. Because if you were to go and pose this question to the CEOs of McKinsey's and SAP respectively, I think they'd turn in their grave with this type of, they just freak when they see this kind of thing happening and putting their brands at this level of risk, etc. where does it go wrong? Because it's clearly not going wrong at that, let's call it senior level, but it is going wrong somewhere between, let me call it, the board of SAP and McKinsey's sitting wherever, and the country management in South Africa. It's clearly going wrong.
It's sort of I think that's why, well, in my discussion with some of the authors of the New Companies Act, that became very clear why that second category of directors were created in the definition, the prescribed officer.
Prescribed officers.
Exactly that person. That person who sits somewhere in an operation, with real power and real decision-making ability, and who is doing things they're not supposed to be doing. And it gets the entire company into trouble. I think if I also can go one step back, you know, we can wave our arms, which we should be doing by all means, but we also need to see stronger authorities involved in this. If one looks at the competition commissioner, and it does have some challenges, et cetera, but overall, I view them as quite successful. They've been able to have, some very good findings, the tribunal, the competition tribunal, with penalties that had to be paid. Why do we still not have a dedicated body in South Africa specifically involved, with the prosecution, not the other stuff, but the prosecution of corruption? I made such a proposal many, many years ago already, my thesis to say, and that's why the Serious Fraud Office in the UK is so successful. They have the resources, the ability, the experts, the training to be able to investigate, for example, a McKinsey case, get the evidence and prosecute, not just fining people, but sending them to jail. And I think if we can start seeing that in the newspapers, that'll encourage all of us that, it doesn't pay to be wrong.
But political will is a prerequisite.
Clearly.
Just as a matter of interest, are people in those positions? So one would think that they are aware and that they are, seasoned executives, etc., in these powerful positions to make important decisions. How aware are they of the liability of making the wrong or the not right decision? And then the other thing is, are they aware of the personal risk? So, we sometimes have to take a step back and self-reflect. Are people really aware of the personal risk?
I don't think they genuinely are. I think the typical thing that happens to the company is, there's some sort of a communique that goes out, guys, note there's been a change to the legislation, don't do the following. And when I address many of the boards, I can clearly see, and they tell me afterwards, really, thank you, this is an eye-opener to us. And we're glad that we've been sensitized about this risk. I don't think they know, I think there's a level, and I think even those who do know, perhaps it is that, I don't want to know. I'd rather rationalize. if I know, it makes me liable.
Yeah.
And that's an old-fashioned way of thinking. What we used to say, and that's what the new personal liability did, it brought in a subjective level as well. Previously, it was objectively. Did you know? Can we prove that you knew about this? If we can't bring the evidence, well, then clearly you had no intent to do wrong in the criminal law. Now it brings in a subjective piece. And it now says, yes, perhaps you can convince us that you didn't know, but in fact, the reasonable person in your position should have known.
Mm.
In other words, you're being negligent and you're liable.
Yeah, and there's that negligence element. Dr. Yonette Minnar, thank you very much for the insights that you've shared with us. I think there's definitely, the old saying, buyer beware. My comment would be, executives, beware. Business owners, beware. The legislative framework has changed. The world of ethics is moved significantly. And yes, please remember, orange is not the new black. Dr. Yonette Minnar, thank you very much, of ProEthics. Thank you very much for your time today. We really do appreciate your insights. Next up, the Youth Leadership Platform.
This is CliffCentral.com.